it's good to see you all tonight, and we can see you because they've left the last house lights up, so that's nice. Bristol NUJ, in partnership with the Arnold Feeney, present the second of our annual lectures, the Benn Lectures, debating and defining the issues, the most pressing issues for journalism and the media today. So it's brilliant that so many people are here, and it's wonderful that Andrew Gilligan's here, a celebrity journalist for all the wrong reasons, really. And I think it's a tribute to his intrepid spirit that he's survived it all. I'm sure I don't need to explain to everybody that Andrew was at the heart of the furore which ended in the tragic suicide of Dr. David Kelly. I remember where I was when that was announced in the media. I'm sure everybody else does. It's a bit like the defining moment when John Kennedy was shot. You always remember where you were. David Kelly's suicide was the consequence of an intolerable amount of pressure from sources which have never really been made clear. Andrew was at the flashpoint of reporting in Iraq at the time, and he was the distinguished journalist who had the honour of telling the public live on the Today programme at, I think, 6:04 a.m. that the weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was prepared to release weapons of mass destruction at 45 minutes notice, which was a justification for us to go to war in Iraq. That caused an enormous scandal and furore, and ended in David Kelly's suicide some while later, and the Hutton inquiry some while later, which said that the BBC was in the wrong. However, the NUJ have always felt that the BBC was right, and we in the National Union of Journalists support Andrew. You'll find it on the website. It says, the NUJ website, it's still there, dated January the 26th, 2004, saying Andrew Gilligan and the BBC was the right story. They were right to pursue the story at the heart of the Hutton inquiry. The story was firmly in the public interest. And it's also, we also said, in the aftermath of the Hutton report, it's vital that the work of Andrew Gilligan is recognised as a great service to the public, that the political and financial independence of the BBC and its public service remit are maintained, and that the right of journalists to protect the anonymity of confidential sources is respected and guaranteed by law. The pressure to reveal sources when an entire government is leaning on you and there's an entire war at stake probably has to be experienced to be believed, and I hope we're going to hear a bit tonight about what that pressure feels like, what Andrew feels the implications are, and what it means for us as journalists working at every level in the media today. So, ladies and gentlemen, I present Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. What I'm going to do is speak for what, about 45 minutes, actually, and then take a few questions afterwards, what you might call a live, unscripted two-way. I'm perhaps quite qualified to talk about journalism tonight because I've done it for all media, and I've experienced it at all levels. There is, of course, the respectable level, the Today programme, the London Evening Standard, where I'm now a reporter and a columnist, Channel 4, for whom I make regular dispatches documentaries, including one with a company based here in Bristol. But I've also had an exciting variety of contacts with what you might call the other side of the business. As well as the documentaries for Channel 4, I've also been a character in a drama on Channel 4 based on the Hutton inquiry. I lobbied the programme makers to be played by Ewan McGregor, but you know what? They refused. The day I really knew I'd arrived on the Z list, though, was when I got the offer to take part in a programme called Celebrity Surgery, described by the makers as, quotes, a natural follow-up to Channel 5's most recent medical reality show, Operations Live, offering you, underlined, the chance to be filmed undergoing a variety of cosmetic procedures under the knife of a Harley Street plastic surgeon. Now, you know, the question I wanted to ask is, how on earth did they know I needed plastic surgery? Anyway, I turned them down. I've been subjected to enough surgery in the media already, I think. I never did get the offer from Celebrity Big Brother, alas. I think, I'm not sure anyone could face even the mental picture of me in a Lycra catsuit. But as well as seeing journalism in all media and at all levels, I see it also from both ends. I've been both reporter and reported on in one of the most intense media storms anyone has ever seen. You might remember it. My thesis tonight is that that story started a period in which the media has been under sustained attack. What started out as a specific attack on a specific journalist, me, went on to become a broader attack on first the BBC's coverage of the war, and then the entire BBC, and then on all journalism. Its most persistent advocate is a man called John Lloyd, who was assistant editor of the Financial Times until they unfortunately sacked him. Not long after the Hutton inquiry, he wrote an important book called What the Media is Doing to Our Politics. He's now director of the Reuters Institute for Study of Journalism at Oxford University. And Lloyd laid out a thesis that has since been taken up enthusiastically by a number of politicians, above all, of course, the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair. You'll remember that with his characteristic calm restraint and moderation, Blair, a few weeks before he left office, made a big speech attacking the media as feral beasts, tearing to shreds the reputations of honest public servants, like himself, in case you were wondering who he had in mind. John Lloyd, too, says in his book that the media has become reflexively cynical, untruthful, confrontational, a corrupter of public life. It is, he believes, responsible for the declining levels of trust in politicians. The media, he says, is a new power in the land, a power that is unaccountable and needs to be held to account. And John's main example, his principal villain in this cesspool of falsehood and distortion, is me, for my story about the government's deceit over its Iraq weapons dossier. Now, I wouldn't make quite the grand claim to my story that some of my supporters make. It wasn't perfect. Very little journalism is perfect. It shouldn't have to be perfect. But it was both overwhelmingly in the democratic interest and overwhelmingly correct. One of the very few media stories up to that point about Iraqi WMD that was actually true. And what we now know, of course, was that, if anything, my story understated the government's duplicity. Now, the fact that John Lloyd was unfortunate enough to choose in me almost diametrically the wrong example doesn't entirely invalidate his general case, I don't think. I would not defend the behaviour of the press. My experience of journalism from the receiving end was often pretty unpleasant. I was struck by quite how frequently my journalistic critics had to distort what I'd said or done in order to be able to condemn me. I have to say that John Lloyd fell into that category in spades, but, you know, he was only writing a book calling for journalistic accuracy. What I learned, however, during my media travails in 2003 was that none of this slanted journalism really mattered very much. It really didn't make much difference. For 6 months, Rupert Murdoch's newspapers, owned, of course, by a major business rival of the BBC, spared no ink to make me and the BBC look like pond life. The Sun once gave over its entire front page to a headline, picture of me under the headline, "You Rat." But on the streets, the taxi drivers are still refusing to take my money. The opinion polls, The Sun, and Times readers, just like everybody else, overwhelmingly believed me and the BBC, and overwhelmingly disbelieved the then Prime Minister, as they continue to do, of course. So what I learned from that is a minority of journalists and proprietors might want to pursue their own agendas, undermine democracy, change the truth, but they have much less power to do so than they'd like to think. It just doesn't work if it goes against the grain of the facts. Journalism, I think, can amplify public feelings that already exist, but it cannot create them from scratch. And one of New Labour's greatest failings has been that it consistently overestimates the importance of the media and underestimates the intelligence of the public. We are not automatons hardwired to the sort of leader page of The Sun or the Today programme, indeed. We are sceptical, distrusting consumers of the press. We make up our minds, we have our own minds, we make them up on the basis of a wide variety of sources of which the media are only one. It's argued that the media have become too disrespectful of ministers, if only that were the case. But in the run-up to the war, with honourable exceptions, the real failing of some journalists, of course, was that they obediently, respectfully towed the government and the military line. Some of us allowed ourselves to become debriefers of the briefers, or spokesmen for the spokesman. The only stories I'm really ashamed of on today are the ones where I accepted at face value the likes of what Jack Straw and Colin Powell were telling me. That kind of journalism will never, of course, get anyone into trouble, but far more of it was inaccurate than any original story I did. So I don't think the reason the government is facing a crisis of trust and credibility has very much to do with the media. The reason the government is distrusted is because it does not tell the truth. Let's remind ourselves of the... let's leave aside Iraq for the moment. Let's remind ourselves of the overhyping which plagued Labour's first term. Anyone remember the £40 billion for the NHS? Turned out to be achieved by double and treble counting the figures. What that means is that even now the government does have real achievements to boast about. It is simply not believed. Let's remind ourselves of last week when we were told that the loss of the data records of half the population was due to the efforts of a junior official. We then learned that in fact the strategy for releasing the records had been cleared by what was called a process manager, a quite senior official. And Whitehall said, no, actually, the latest we've learned is actually, no, when we say junior official, we mean, well, we could mean middle-ranking official as well, or indeed quite senior official. Junior official is anyone basically south of the permanent secretary. That's their argument now. Obviously the data thing could have happened to anyone, but it does show up a couple of particular problems with New Labour. Their complete carelessness about personal information and privacy, and also their rather casual attitude to the truth. Then, of course, there is Iraq. And what we didn't fully comprehend until the Butler report was quite how extraordinary the government's behaviour actually was. We learned that the intelligence presented to us by the Prime Minister as detailed, authoritative and compelling was actually silo floor sweepings from second-hand sources, third-hand sources, sources reporting things they'd sort of heard from their circles of contact. That's an actual phrase from the Butler report. We learned that the Prime Minister claimed there was a growing threat after he'd actually been told the threat was static or even diminishing. We learned that one of the dossier's central claims was underpinned by a source who was on trial, in the words of the Butler report, and had never been used or tested before. A secret agent on work experience. And these people presumed to lecture the media on standards of accuracy? It is now clear to me, at least, that the legendary dossier was the rough equivalent for a journalist of writing a front-page news story based on something that your minicab driver heard down the pub in 1995. Except, of course, that no news story ever became part of a case for killing 100,000 people. It's argued that the media undermines democracy by alienating and disconnecting the public from the political process. Quite the reverse, I think. Those of us who cover politics spend our time trying to connect people. We want people to read about politics. The reason people feel disconnected from the political process is not because of the media, it's because they are disconnected. At the last election, the government won 36% of the votes, but 55% of the seats in the House of Commons. If you factor in turnout, it actually won the positive endorsement of little more than one-fifth of the electorate, 22% to be precise. Yet that incredibly feeble popular mandate delivered tremendous power. Not just over things like war and peace. The issues which people care about most, of course, are extremely local: schools, crime, roads, planning. But control of all those things has been taken away from elected councillors and to Whitehall, which, in England at least, runs the most centralised and secretive large democracy in the world. So that is what undermines our democratic process, the fact that our representative democracy is not nearly representative or democratic enough. Over the question of Iraq, the most serious question you can possibly imagine, the committing of our troops to war against a country which had offered no provocation to us. Nearly all the democratic institutions which are supposed to protect us failed. The civil service, in the person of John Scarlett, chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, became Alistair Campbell's co-conspirator. Parliament, in the form of the Foreign Affairs Committee, was more concerned with trying to humiliate David Kelly than with getting to the bottom of the dossier business. and the judiciary in the form of Lord Hutton. Well, I just don't know what happened to Lord Hutton. Not only did the institutions fail, they have failed to acknowledge their failures, and they continue to pretend that all is well. In the US, the director of the CIA who presented misleading intelligence was fired. In the UK, John Scarlett has been promoted. He is now in charge of MI6. The only thing which actually, if belatedly, got its act together and sort of worked eventually, the only estate in the realm which did its job with any kind of effectiveness was the fourth estate, us. It was very, very imperfect, but in the end, it worked. Lloyd and his chums continue to argue that the profession is suffering a crisis of trust. Reporting which allegedly stresses advocacy over facts has, they say, led to a dramatic decline in the credibility of reporters. Now, I have had a look at this, and sadly, when you look at it, the thesis turns out to be itself a rather good example of advocacy taking preference over the facts. The only annual poll measuring the perceived truthfulness of different professions, conducted by Morrie for the British Medical Association and available on its website if you want to look, actually shows that trust in journalists as a whole doubled between 1993 and 2006, though still only admittedly to the rather horribly low level of 20%. Even that, though, is not the full picture. The public is perfectly capable of distinguishing between different types of journalist. A YouGov poll for the Daily Telegraph in 2003 showed virtually no one, 14%, trusted red-top tabloid reporters, and who can blame them? But there were striking levels of trust in broadsheet journalists, 65%, and especially in broadcasters, up to 82%. Far more, incidentally, than ministers in the current Labour government, which is also polled, and they got 25%. Now, a similar pattern, same kind of distribution, slightly lower values, emerged in a more recent survey carried out by the Committee in Standards on Public Life. Now, both those polls were carried out before all the TV fakery scandals, but though those were terrible self-inflicted wounds, I think none directly affected news journalism. The fakery will, of course, have an effect on trust, and it will deserve to. But it is still, I think, of a wholly different order than the deceit practiced by governments. So I am proud that journalism, including my journalism, got closer to the truth more quickly over Iraq than did anything else. It's a reminder that it can still do important things. And I am pleased that the Tony Blair, John Lloyd critique of the press hasn't really taken. Yet, although they may have lost the political argument, although I don't think there's much doubt in the general public that I and the BBC were right and the government was wrong and that the Iraq war was missold to us. Although they've lost the political argument, the forces of hostility to journalism have, I think, recently chalked up some arguably more significant practical victories. Take leaks. They are a mainstay of journalism, and of course, one without which literally thousands of stories in the public interest would never have been told. But over the last 2 years, there's been quite a serious clampdown on unapproved official information. Civil servants, diplomats and soldiers have been placed under new obligations not to write memoirs and are being required to assign their copyright in any they do write to the government. Leakers of prima facie public interest material have been prosecuted, convicted and even jailed with remarkably little fuss from the media. In 1984, you might remember, the trial of Clive Ponting for leaking the Belgrano documents became a cause célèbre, hugely covered in the press and resulting in Ponting's acquittal. But earlier this year, in an exactly parallel case, two men, David Keogh and Joe O'Connor, were sent to prison for leaking a copy of a memo in which George Bush and Tony Blair discussed, ironically, bombing a TV station, Al Jazeera. That trial went virtually unreported, partly because the judge banned anyone from reporting the contents of the memo, even though it was public knowledge. And again, nobody really made a fuss about that. Another man, Derek Pascoe, is currently awaiting trial for leaking memos to the New Statesman's Martin Bright, detailing the complicity of the government with the Muslim Council of Britain, memos whose publication led to a major change in government policy. Now, neither of those leaks jeopardised national security. There were classic political embarrassment uses of the Official Secrets Act, but the almost total lack of protest from the media has sent a chilling message to potential future leakers. You are on your own. And not only have leakers started being arrested, so have the journalists they leaked to. 3 weeks ago, a report on the Milton Keynes Citizen, Sally Murrah, was charged with abetting misconduct in public office an offence which carries a potential jail sentence. Her alleged crime was to have received leaked information from a police officer about the staff at the Central Police Station at Milton Keynes losing the keys to the cells. Her home and the offices of her newspaper were searched, her DNA was taken, and she was locked up for the night in the cells. Now, if any journalist who had allegedly received leaked information from a police officer were arrested, there wouldn't be many of us left. Maybe that's what they want. Let's remember another police leak, a rather important one, the story broken by ITV News that Jean-Charles de Menezes had not, as the police claimed, been running away when he was shot, that he had not, as the police claimed, had on a heavy coat, and that he was not, in fact, offering any resistance. He was being held down, in fact, when he was shot, and 7 bullets were pumped into his head. Critical details from a leaked IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, report, which had, until that point, been secret, and which electrified the whole de Menezes story. The ITN journalist who received that leak and the IPCC secretary who leaked it to him were arrested. To this day, they remain the only two people to have been arrested in connection with the death of Jean-Charles de Menezes. Not the officers who killed him, not the police commissioner who misled us, but the journalists who exposed the untruths. So journalists, I think, are very far from immune from the creeping growth of state power that we're now seeing in Britain. The police and the authorities have far greater powers than they used to have to demand material, obtain telephone and email data, seize and search, and they are using them more and more. They've even started branching out the police into TV criticism. Witness the recent quite extraordinary decision by West Midlands Police to report the programme I work on, Dispatches, although not an edition I did, as it happens, to Ofcom for what it claimed were systematic distortions in the editing of an expose of Muslim extremists in Birmingham. There weren't, of course, any such distortions, as Ofcom has just found. But even if there had been, it is the responsibility of the police to investigate crime, not editorial standards in television. Nor are the courts, I don't think, always terribly helpful. Mr. Justice Eady, the man who hears most libel cases in the High Court, is developing a clear track record of favouring the privacy provisions of the Human Rights Act over the ones guaranteeing freedom of expression. I could tell you quite a lot of stories about the things he's banned, but I probably would be locked up if I did that. Among the stories he's ruled must be kept secret are one which involves a man describing how a very well-known public figure, a political figure we'd all know, stole his wife. Individually, none of these things are particularly serious. Collectively, they represent a real tightening of the strings round journalism's neck. But I haven't yet come to the most serious part of the attack on journalism, from within the media industry itself. Well, what's happened over the last 20 years, broadly since Rupert Murdoch's move to Wapping, is that it's become possible to make money from newspapers. Because of the print unions, it never used to be. Newspapers weren't really proper businesses. People owned them not for profit, but for prestige or influence. Suddenly, almost overnight, with the print unions taken out of the equation, the newspapers became increasingly profitable. Incredibly profitable, actually. They started to be treated like any other business. So owners were able to do the usual things. Consolidations, mergers, squeezing costs, takeovers. And of course there were plenty of costs to be squeezed. There was a lot of waste. But a lot of the owners, I'm thinking say of Trinity Mirror, didn't know where to stop. They got greedy. Even though they were making very good profits from their newspapers, they wanted to make more and more. And by that time they were cutting into the bone. And often with managers who seem to regard journalism as very little different from any other consumer product, like washing machines or cars. So over the last 20 years, we've seen a dramatic decline in the number of reporting journalists, but a dramatic increase in the amount of space they have to fill. They have to do far more stories with far less time on each story. Producing a car in less time might be a good idea. It's a standard product. It's easy to check whether or not it works. It probably does make it cheaper. But journalism, of course, is not a standard product. And producing journalism in less time risks fundamentally altering its nature. Because at the same time as the number of journalists has shrunk, the number of anti-journalists, if you like, has risen to fill the gap. If you were writing a story about a hospital, you used to be able to speak to the manager or the consultant. If you were writing about a crime, you used to be able to speak to the investigating officer in charge. Now, however, of course, you have to speak to the PR. And every organisation, private and public, has seen a massive increase in this army of anti-journalists. And increasingly, because we are so thin on the ground and so overstretched, they're not just managing contact with the media, they are shaping the content of the media. They are writing the newspapers, because we, the hacks, often don't have time to do much more than process what they give us. And that might help explain why, to begin with, we did so badly over Iraq. I think most journalists want two things. They want stories, and they want other people to follow up their stories. And the government PRs knew that. They provided juicy stories. There was a great one in the Sunday Telegraph, where I used to work, this is after I'd left, about the belly dancers of death. Anyone remember that one? This was that a secret operation, codenamed Operation Falcon, according to Western intelligence sources, was aiming to fan out highly trained Iraqi killer agents disguised as actresses and belly dancers into the streets of London to kill and maim dissidents. And, you know, this complete load of old drivel was swallowed wholesale by the Sunday Times, because they knew, Sunday Telegraph, because they knew that it would be confirmed the following day by the Foreign Office, as it duly was, and it would be followed up, as it duly was, by other newspapers. And that, for that particular journalist who wrote that story, became his definition of truth. The fact is, it just wasn't in his interest to do the routine journalistic checks that would have exposed that story as the nonsense it was, because it was a story, it was going to be confirmed. I was on the BBC by that point, and I was invited to follow it up by my editor. I rang the Home Office, actually, and asked how many visas have been granted for Iraqi belly dancers in the last 15 years, and they said none. How many visas have been granted for any kind of belly dancers, and they said one. So I don't think that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And increasingly, what we're finding is official sources are not just sources of news, they're also arbiters of news. Because if you do a story on your own, if you do the work, you do an investigation, you beaver away for weeks on your own, you come up with a great story. The fact is, it might be rather inconvenient to those in power. It will often be denied. It will not be followed up by your colleagues. And you need exceptional determination in a newspaper, or more importantly, with exceptional determination to keep it going. The Guardian's expose of BAE's bribery was one such example. They had to keep plugging away at that, you know, pretty much every week for literally months before anyone else took it up, because it was denied and denied and denied. And only very, very few newspapers have the kind of determination shown by The Guardian on that story, a determination which eventually, but only eventually, paid off. I think, unfortunately, with the way journalism is going, the economics is only going to become more difficult. We see, of course, the rise of the web. In some ways, it's a very good thing. It democratizes information. It's an immensely important research tool for journalists. You can get reports and information that would take you weeks to get previously. You can get them in a few hours. However, it does mean, quite clearly, is draining money out of journalism. It's much harder to make money from a web-based product than a print-based one, and that means fewer reporters. And it also means, frankly, less authoritative reporters. We talk about citizen journalism, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm a citizen as well. And I happen to think, along with the Guardian reporter David Lee, that we do need to make the point that not all voices are equal in this debate. Not all voices are equal. Some voices have more skill at investigating than others. Some voices have more knowledge and specialist expertise than others. Those voices should be heard more than others. Journalism is not something that anyone can just walk in off the street and do straight away and be brilliant at straight away. What's the answer? I mean, I can tell you what's not the answer. I went to a conference of Media Workers Against the War last week, and literally after virtually every questioner slagging off state lies for question after question, and they all went on to say, well, actually, the answer is a state watchdog to enforce accuracy on the media. Well, I'm sorry, you know, I mean, there's obviously a fundamental contradiction there. A state watchdog would end up being an absolute albatross round our necks, as would any form of press regulation, which is sometimes suggested by the kind of Roy Greenslade, John Lloyd school of affairs. The answer, I think, is that we ourselves, as journalists, have got to stand up for journalism, rather as the defence chiefs have finally started to stand up for their troops, which they've done it a bit earlier. We've got to start saying to our employers and the world, we can't go on like this, we can't work properly like this. The union, I think, the NEJ, is very important, both in defending jobs and quality where they're at risk, as, of course, at the BBC at the moment and in ITV regional news. It's absolutely vital that the struggle against cuts at the BBC is waged and won. I think there's a reasonable chance, because it's a very heavily unionised workplace, there's quite a lot of anger there. It's been extremely badly handled by the management, and a lot of people are very, very unhappy. There is no doubt at all that cutting jobs out of BBC, there's no doubt at all there's huge waste in the BBC. I mean, I used to walk around when I worked there, the upper reaches of TV centre, marvelling at the kind of sheer lunacy of the job titles on the offices and the upper floors, sort of director of paperclips resource marketing, and, you know, and it's just amazing. But actually, in the bits that actually did the work, they were incredibly overstretched. They're always all filthy. They never got clean. Today office never ever got clean because it was a 24-hour operation. The cleaners could never get in. And there are all these hollow-eyed 25-year-olds on 25 grand a year working 12-hour days. And literally, we have 55 people on today to produce 17 hours of radio a week. And we couldn't play any records. We couldn't take any phone calls. We had to produce all that radio ourselves. Very often we nearly didn't make it. Very, very often we were like literally one 22-year-old production assistant from falling off air. It all sounds very smooth on the surface. It's incredibly panic-stricken and crisis-ridden underneath. And that was a flagship programme. God knows what the rest are like. So there's not a great deal of slack in BBC journalism. There's a great deal of slack elsewhere in the BBC. But that is not the slack that's being attacked. So that's what the union, that's probably the most important thing the union can do. But also the other thing which it do more of, it really needs to do more of, is build links with other organisations such as Liberty, where we share common interests. It's quite clear, for instance, a threat to human rights and fundamental liberties in this country is a threat. You know, journalists used to assume they were kind of to some extent protected from this, protected from being arbitrarily arrested when they were covering demonstrations or whatever. But increasingly, that's no longer the case. So we quite clearly share the interest of the general public in living in a free society. I think it is possible to roll back elements of state power. I think we're seeing it now. Actually, the government's having a great deal more difficulty than it expected bringing in its extended detention powers. Our formal democratic structures may be pretty rubbish, but our civil society, our informal means of pressure, including, above all, most importantly of all, the press, are strong. What I think we also need, and maybe the union can help here, is a newspaper or a magazine about the press, you know, reporting. We need to turn the spotlight on ourselves. We need a sort of, I don't know, a weekly or a monthly publication that will kind of expose, mock and humiliate the bad. Forensically investigate dodgy stories, shame people, make it very difficult for them to do, you know, root out some of the dodgy practices that absolutely plague our trade, nepotism things. I mean, I can't tell you how many people called Dimbleby there are working at the BBC, about 15. And also we need to celebrate the good, because, you know, the best answer to bad journalism is not state regulation, I think. The best answer to bad journalism is good journalism. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to take any questions, of course, as well. Yeah. Lady in the middle there. Yeah, you're holding the microphone, yeah.
Oh. Hi, I'm Susie Weldon from the Western Daily Press. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed your lecture and I agreed with everything you said in the last point about some of the remedies. But speaking as someone who works in the regional press and has recently been through redundancy process and has seen firsthand the pressures, the increasing pressures that are being placed upon journalists out of the greed of newspaper proprietors, I suppose I've become increasingly despondent about journalism's ability to withstand the economic pressures. And I just wonder what you think of that, because it just seems to me that they are cutting even further into the bone, and I truly don't see how anyone has time to do more than recycle press releases.
Yeah, the situation in the regional press is probably the most serious, actually, of anywhere in the media. Because what we have here are newspaper groups, including my own sister group, Northcliffe Newspapers, which owns your paper, right? You know, they make substantial profits
from their papers. I'm not sure what Northcliffe's profits are, but I know Trinity Mirror's regional profit is 9% or something year on year, which is a very, very good profit. But they want more and more. I hate to say this, but the most important weapon you have is to withdraw your labour. And I know the trouble is it's very difficult to get people organised in journalism. It's not a trade, and this is one of the things I should probably have mentioned in my speech. It's not a trade that's particularly big on solidarity. It's composed of very, individualistic people, and of course to some extent you have to be a journalist. You have to be quite self-centred even. And one of the things I noticed when I was in trouble over Hutton was how few journalists were, actually quite a few journalists were prepared to come to my support, but quite a few were deeply hostile and critical, and a lot of others just enjoyed the spectacle and started piling in. And I thought that was silly. That wasn't in their own interest either, because it was the whole of journalism that was under attack. It would have had implications for them if the attack they were mounting on us had succeeded. I can't see many other ways in which you can bring pressure to bear on your employers. And it will soon come to reach a critical stage. I know that's probably it's probably quite a big step for anyone to take, but somebody needs to make a stand for editorial quality, because very soon you're right, you will be reduced to reprocesses of press releases.
I'd like to just put a bit of background in there to say that here in Bristol we have been really well organised in the newspaper, but the difficulty with organising and withdrawing labour is one of regulation.
Absolutely,
as much as anything else. I mean, Susie and her colleagues and others in Bristol have gone right to the wire on trying to get that sorted out.
Absolutely,
And what stops people isn't solidarity within the workplace, which is very... In Bristol, we have the only NUJ chapel in any Northcliffe newspaper in the country, I think, apart from Leicester. So it's exceptional here, but it just hasn't been possible to create strikes because of the anti-strike legislation and the anti-union legislation. So,
I fully understand the difficulties. I mean, I work for a one of the other things I do is I work for an Iranian TV channel called Press TV, and they are in negotiations with the NUJ at the moment, and industrial relations legislation makes it quite difficult and cumbersome to get organised there. There is one other possible avenue, if the law makes it too difficult, which is the kind of sort of public humiliation avenue. Now it's difficult to bring enough pressure to bear on people, but again, I'm a great believer in the power of focused information. I think that's probably potentially a huge force for change in our society. Too many people think about protest in terms of demonstrations and petitions. Now, frankly, when was the last demonstration or petition that ever achieved anything? I mean, even the biggest demonstration in British history didn't achieve anything. We have to think of new ways to protest, and one of the best ways is to dig out information that is deeply embarrassing to people in power, makes them change their minds, brings enough pressure on them to change their minds. And as journalists, of course, we are professionals at digging out information, so that shouldn't be impossible for us. I couldn't help thinking, for instance, I remember during railway privatisation, I thought, if somebody had kind of given me a year off, you could see the railway privatisation being a total disaster coming down the track. I know quite a lot about the railways. And I kind of thought at the time, why don't I get someone like the Roundtree Trust to pay me, X amount of money, and I can take a year off from the paper, and I can actually just spend the full time, a sort of forensic investigation job, on all the impossibilities of railway privatisation and try and, get contacts in the whole area and bring out embarrassing documents. And it might have been possible with a really focused campaign to derail that. There's quite a lot of stuff you can do. I mean, I remember when we were campaigning against changes to the Freedom of Information Act, David Lee and I and Rob Evans, David's sort of oppo at The Guardian, and several other people, did a kind of sort of quite a focused campaign of articles and exposés and things, digging out information that proved the government was acting for totally cynical motives. And it did have an effect, actually. They did back down. They actually backed down. They decided not to restrict the Freedom of Information Act in the way that they had been proposing. But you need to kind of coordinate it, just not just the release of information, but also then coordinate it with, you know, questions to draw up questions for sympathetic MPs, early day motions, kind of, you know, bring all the political pressure together. And that can have a tremendous impact if it's done properly and coordinated properly. So that is another potential route. And that's what I mean by saying that the NUJ should be more into that kind of thing. I know it's a resource thing, but that's the kind of thing it should be doing, because it can have a tremendous effect. This is not, you know, however we may moan, this is not dictatorship. There are avenues of civil society. There are levers you can pull, and they can be pulled to effect. Any more questions? Yeah, man in the middle there. Do you want to wait for the mic, and then everyone can hear?
I would like to speak as a member of the public that has other concerns than freedom of information or the freedom of the press and expression. I've been much involved with special interest campaign groups, which particularly in the field of development and planning, and trying to redress the balance between the rights of the individual and small communities and the very wealthy development industry, which has unlimited resources to fight, and of course the law itself, planning law, is loaded against the ordinary individual and the ordinary community. We had a series of lectures off campus in the university some years ago, given by George Monbiot, who has written, as you know, some very good case histories of the maladministration. And in the end, we asked George Monbiot how we could improve our performance in getting the media to take up the issues which concerned us. And George said, well, you've got to actually learn how the media works and get alongside reporters and give them useful information.
Yeah.
Now, if you receive such involvement, can you, in the industry, in the actual activity of producing newspapers, have you got? Is it effective to have that sort of
It absolutely
rapport.
Is, yeah. No, it absolutely is. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, you know, PRs and things don't just have to work for the forces of evil. They can work for you. And actually, one of the things it might be useful to do in the defence of journalism, as in this cause that you're talking about, is to actually have a full-time person. I mean, someone like Andrew Green of Migration Watch. Now, Andrew Green of Migration Watch is just Andrew Green. There's hardly anybody else. You ring them and he answers the phone. Which is a bit of a come down, really, for the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia answering the phone. But nonetheless, simply on his own, by just being there, being a spokesman on 24-hour call for the media, he has managed to propel the issue of migration. Not an issue, I mean, his take on it is not one I share in any way, but he has managed to propel that issue right up to the top of the agenda. Now, if there was someone to talk about developer power or bad journalism or media attacks or useless media owners on a 24/7 basis who could go on News 24 at 5 seconds' notice and talk about it, that would rise the issue up the political agenda. And actually, when you mentioned about developer power, you're talking my language, because I did a dispatches on this in July the 30th, which is fascinating stuff. I mean, I remember we found some extraordinary stuff going on. We found there's a lobbying firm called PPS, based in London, which works in this rather specialised branch of the PR industry, which is basically, if you want to build an Asda in Salisbury Cathedral Close, they're the people you get. They will help you get planning permission for any difficult scheme, and they will stop at nothing. And we found a scheme in Fulham, actually, called Imperial Wharf, by a big developer. We found that they had bugged meetings of local councillors, private meetings. We found they had gone round to the councillors pretending to be students, researching a PhD thesis to find out what they thought about the development. We found they had faked letters. We ran around several, we got all the letters that had been written to the council in support of it. It was funny, I mean, I spoke to one of the councillors and he said, you know, everyone's normally against these kind of things, but we just suddenly got this stream of about 50 letters all saying how wonderful it was. And we got some of the letters and they were ludicrous and they said things like, you know, what is wrong with you councillors? Get on with this scheme at once. And, you know, the sort of thing that nobody would say, even if they were, you know, nobody in this country. And you know, anyway, so we thought, right, well, let's go and have a look at see some of these letters. We ran around to see the people whose names were on the letters and whose signatures were on the letters, and they said they'd never seen them in their lives. Either they'd signed completely different letters saying they were against a scheme, and their signature had just been cut and pasted onto one saying they were in favour, or they hadn't signed anything at all. We found one guy who said he was in the Caribbean for the whole 6 months when he didn't even know it was happening. So that was fun. And of course the lobbying company kind of really harumphed and threatened to sue us and send writs and so forth. So far, and it's what 3 months on now, 4 months on, they haven't sent anything. So I take it they're not going to. But no, I mean they have tremendous power, but you have also a considerable advantage in your lack of professionalism, because you are seen to be the people, and you know the public will take your side, and newspaper readers will like reading about you. You have to combine, if you like, professionalism and amateurism. You have to present the face of amateurs, but you have to present yourselves professionally, and you know, be available, for instance, to journalists, and work out stories that they will be interested in. And there can be incredibly fruitful relationships between journalists and members of community groups and pressure groups, because some of the best stories come from people like that who are on the ground. Now, I'm not saying at all, by the way, that we should take these stories without checking. I think quite often community groups have problematic agendas of their own, and they'll want to push things a bit too far. It does not excuse me of my professional obligation to check, just as it wouldn't excuse me of my professional obligation to check a press release from, you know, Bristol City Council or something. But there can be very fruitful relationships. I'll give you another example. We found there's a very good group in Essex called Stop Stansted Expansion, who have really got this strategy right down to a T. And after I did this programme about the fake letters, they rang up and said, we think we've got something like that in Stansted, you come down and have a look. And indeed, they had. Now, you know, I couldn't have found those letters in a million years, because I've had to look through every... they've written loads of fake letters that appeared in local newspapers saying Stansted expansion's a wonderful thing. And I would never have spotted that in a million years, but it was something they could spot, and they knew the journalist to call, and they called me, and I came and did it. So, I think it's a very good idea, and there's some really quite good books. There's a very old one by a man called Dennis McShane, who used to be an NUJ official and used to be rather a good guy, and of course now... became a Labour minister and is now a backbench MP. It's called Using the Media. If you can find it, it's extremely good, actually. A really good template for how to get your stuff into the media.
Thank you very much.
Any more questions? Yeah.
You mentioned the 10 service, and you got promoted after the
And a lot of us rather get the uncomfortable feeling that there is a sort of collective agenda going on, which is coming from the intelligence services, that is threading through things. I've heard from an ex-MI5 officer that Tony Blair was registered with the intelligence services before he ever became leader of the Labour Party. And, of course, intelligence services benefit greatly when there is a war going on, because they are supposed to be secretly defending our national interests. I was wondering if you'd like to make a comment on that.
I don't know if any of you saw a very interesting piece in the New Statesman by David Rose, correspondent on The Observer, about 6 weeks ago, end of September type time. And it's well worth looking up on the website of the New Statesman if you want to look for it. Essentially, he says that the intelligence services pretty much do as you say. They do follow a political agenda. They do try and influence the political debate by briefing selected journalists, and often briefing misleadingly. And the problem with intelligence sources is that you can't, you know, you have to take what they say on trust. You can't, you know, by definition, you can't verify secret intelligence, which is why I never really bother to get involved with intelligence services at an official level. And there were people there. I mean, both of the intelligence agencies, MI5 and MI6, have spokespeople. whose numbers I had, who would make themselves available to select a journalist, of whom I was one, and they would take you out to lunch and things, and they would pay. And it's all here, it's all there in Rose's piece, actually. Now, they never took me out to lunch, but I did ring them occasionally to check things. But there were a number of journalists, of whom David Rose is one, Con Coughlin on The Telegraph is another, who became rather uncritical recipients of what can only be described as intelligence service spin. That story I mentioned to you about the belly dancers of death, although it's got somebody else's name on that, came from Con Coughlin, and it came from, I don't know exactly who, but it came from some intelligence service person. Equally, there was another case I remember about Colonel Gaddafi's son, which ended up in court. Now, that was a Con Coughlin story. He sourced it to banking sources, but actually it came out in court that his source on that was MI6. And the story was completely wrong, and had been planted by MI6 as part of a campaign to destabilise Gaddafi, who was an enemy at that point, although, of course, he's now best chums. So there's no doubt at all that the intelligence services use the media. I think it's a bit subtler than you say. I mean, I don't think they actually wanted a war. I think they were rather horrified, to be honest, the way they got drawn in the end. They allowed themselves, I think they realised, well, I know they realised that it was a serious mistake to allow themselves to be drawn in this political arena in that sort of way, but they nonetheless do have, they are not beyond, manipulating the media through briefings of selected journalists, which you either have to take or leave, and all too many journalists do take them, of course. We continue to see that in all the response about 7/7, the claims made by intelligence sources in the aftermath of that, nearly all been exposed as untrue. The claim, for instance, that the bombers were not known to the intelligence service, that's been exposed definitively as untrue. So too many journalists talk to intelligence sources, too many journalists believe what they hear. Now, I talk to them, but I take what they say with a big pinch of salt. Yeah, up front. Sorry. Oh, someone. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go on. Right back.
How do you feel about the fact that there's a growing movement in the world asking for new investigations regarding the attacks?
I haven't personally done any work at all on the 9/11 alternative theories. Let me not call them conspiracy theories.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm an engineer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest, without actually going and looking at it in any detail, I can't know whether the official accounts are credible or not, and I never have looked.
What I'm worried about is this is such a monumental day in terms of all our faith and our destiny that not one newspaper or mainstream media channel has even touched on this. And I'm amazed that they can have this much control to keep something as important as this out of the newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, this... I don't know. All I can say is I have never looked at it.
Why not? Is that the term conspiracy?
Well, it's just why not? It's just
it's really
quite. My feeling is, look. I mean, I'm not quite so cynical as you. I don't think that a government would do something that horrific to its own citizens. I really don't. Yeah.
There's a couple of things to say here, and thanks a lot for that comment because it is a huge issue. I think one thing is that in Bristol there have been two events within the last 12 months, which, if you're interested in the 9/11 bombings, I'm sure you went to.
Well, we've got a meeting going on tonight.
Yeah. There were, and I chaired it myself, one of them, the janitor from the 9/11 bombings, was here at Bristol less than 12 months ago, and he came and gave his account. So if you were there, you will have seen it. The other thing is that because it happened in the US, and it is a US political problem, it's very important to hold the agenda of this meeting tonight, which is about the British political situation, and in particular Andrew's situation. So given that he hasn't been able to work on it, you know, I think we do need to move on from this topic right now. But if you want to say that you've got a meeting tonight, that's great, and maybe some people will come to it.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah,
thanks.
All right. Okay. Another one from the front there. Yeah.
Yes, you said something about good journalism and bad journalism.
You said something about good journalism and bad journalism. I think that it's an important distinction because I think that there's an important role, investigative role of the journalist. There's also the role where, unfortunately, journalists are disseminating a lot of misinformation. And there's also, I think, a lot of mediocre journalism where they're clearly feeding out what's coming in. From Migration Watch is a very good example. And I wondered, in a sense it follows from the question up there, but I wonder what the role is of the employer and how hidebound the journalist is.
It does depend to some extent on the employer, and I'm afraid, like I said, there are increasing numbers of employers who see journalism as just another product, and they don't really mind what sort of comes off the production line so long as it sort of approximately looks all right. And there's an awful lot of journalism. Nick Davis, the Guardian journalist, one of the relatively few people left who's still doing classic investigative journalism, got a very good book coming out called Flat Earth News about this, and about how things that kind of become conventional wisdom without any real backing to them. They just become conventional wisdom because they've been reported, and then somebody else reports and somebody else reports it, and it becomes the accepted norm. And obviously the presence of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction was one such conventional wisdom. And that's that's a real problem, because the trouble is, unfortunately, going beyond the accepted norm and the conventional wisdom does take time, and it does take resources, and it's not going to, it's not necessarily going to make you popular. It's not necessarily going to win you readers, because the public is as prey to conventional wisdom as many journalists, and you've got to have a media owners who believe in, being unpopular, and who believe in kind of upsetting the traces a bit. There aren't very many of those left. I mean, there are still some in the local media, I think, but they're becoming a very endangered species there. It's probably I'd say some also in the national media, probably a slightly higher proportion, but not enough. I mean, I do think we need to sort of create, as I said before, a sort of Migration Watch type organisation to sort of up the pressure for good journalism. So an Andrew Green type figure who can go, well, actually, this story is totally untrue, and here's why. Or somebody who can say, look, it's completely wrong for the Western Morning News to be cutting all these jobs because, a newspaper that used to be produced with X people is now only produced with half that number, and it cannot possibly be as good. And sort of that's probably the only way it's going to work. It's not necessarily going to work from within. Because unfortunately, the other thing is, I happen to work for a group I work for the Evening Standard, part of the evil Associated Empire, but actually the Standard's not that evil, and is a bit evil, but not that evil. And also the Associated does believe whatever you say about it in journalism. They do invest heavily in journalism. That's one of the great strengths. And they do pay journalists properly, and they do give them time to do their work. And I have a great deal of freedom at the Standard, for which I'm very grateful. Unfortunately, though, it's not always the case that investment. It is the case in the Mail versus Express market, where the Mail has clearly massively out-trumped the Express through investment in journalism. But it's not always the case that investment in journalism leads to higher sales. Pressure has to be applied through more than purely commercial means, because it's not always in employers' self-interest to invest in journalism.
Also, to add to that, just to say that the NUJ has been campaigning for a while now for a conscience clause, and there's also an ethics council within the union which looks at these questions all the time. So there is work going on. How effective it is another matter, because we have...
Who's
courses.
Next? Yeah.
I'd I'd like to ask you a question about the use of language. As somebody who's been referred to as a rat by a leading national newspaper, taking into account the Hutton inquiry and the fact that apparently a particular word that was used that affected Stephen Kelly's state of mind very seriously was the word chaff. He was referred to as chaff, not by the media, but by a Labour politician. And he was also said, according to his wife, that he felt that he was being treated as a fly. And this choice of this word fly apparently affected his state of mind very seriously. So I was wondering, as somebody who's been referred to by another animal, rather larger, whether you had any views on whether what good practice would be in terms of the choice of this type of language, these sorts of metaphors, by the media.
Clearly, both those epithets you referred to weren't applied to David Kelly by the media, as you say. I must admit, when I heard that David had killed himself, I was absolutely, obviously, horrified, but also very surprised, because I thought he was a very tough sort of guy. He'd been a weapons inspector in Iraq, for God's sake. I mean, he'd been up against worse people than Alistair Campbell. I've been many times to Iraq under Saddam myself, and I knew how difficult it could get. And I thought, what happened here? And I started to realise that David, in some ways, although very scientifically sophisticated, wasn't politically a lot less experienced. Finding himself in this horrendous Westminster maelstrom with kind of evil insults being thrown around, or against him and me and all the rest of it. Now, I could kind of cope with that, frankly. I mean, I didn't like it, but I knew it was just politics. I knew that it was Westminster chess beating, really. Trevor Kavanagh says I'm the worst journalist in the history of creation. Trevor Kavanagh's never even met me. And as for Trevor Kavanagh, it's politically the sun, by the way, or was. Trevor Kavanagh being entitled to call anyone a bad journalist. Well, I think, it's satirical. It never really bothered me when the sun slagged me off and stuff like that, because I knew it was all just Westminster games. But I think he didn't realise it was, and he took it very, very, very much to heart. When the government, the government broke a number of promises to him. Of course, they said his name wouldn't be made public. It was. They said he wouldn't have to appear in public. He did. They deliberately belittled him and his status. They said he was a junior employee, which simply wasn't true. Another junior employee. Seems we've got a lot of those. I can see why it was so upsetting for him. I do, by the way, in case anyone wants to ask, do believe he committed suicide. I don't think that the question. I know there's some quite interesting evidence brought out by Norman Baker MP, who I know very well and like. And Norman came to me actually when he was researching the book, and said I don't think he committed suicide. And I said actually I do, because the question I keep coming back to is, in whose interest could it possibly have been to murder him? The fact is, his death plunged the British government into the worst crisis it's ever faced, a crisis from which it still hasn't really recovered, so it simply wouldn't have been in their interest to murder him, even if you do believe, as I do not, in fact, that they are in the habit of going around popping off their own employees in the middle of fields in Oxfordshire. I think they'd have done it a lot more neatly than that, and a lot more quietly, and a time of a lot less if they wanted to. So that's my thing on Kelly, but I agree with you. I mean, political language, I think, sometimes there does need to be harshness in political language, I think. But not all of Blair's feral beasts critique was totally, totally ill-deserved. And sometimes, he said that, every setback for the government's always depicted as a kind of total catastrophe. And of course, the trouble is, when you kind of crank up the register every single time, you lose, you can't tell when it's really a total catastrophe, and you can't tell when it isn't, and it's just a minor catastrophe. So there is a danger in using overinflated language on both sides of the political divide. Yeah.
You've mentioned that, the Freedom of Information Act has become very important to a journalist. What do you think turned the Labour government from passing the Freedom of Information Act to now being against journalists, to be briefing against them? What do you reckon it was that turned the Labour government?
I'm afraid it's the old difference between opposition and government. Oppositions, all oppositions, are full of wonderful progressive ideas to redistribute power and information to other people, because they haven't got power and information at that point, and they believe in they believe in all these progressive things, and then suddenly you get into power and you find, well, actually I've got the power, actually I think I'm quite good at holding on to power, I think I'm a very good guardian of being in power, I don't really need to redistribute it to all these other people, it's going to cause me a lot of problems actually, and I'm afraid it's a bit, the Labour Party made this progressive commitment to FOI when it was in opposition, and it was one of these things that that Blair didn't really want to do, I think a little bit like the Scottish Parliament actually, didn't really want to do Human Rights Act, but he was kind of stuck with them. He committed to them very publicly. He couldn't go back on them. So what they did, in fact, was they implemented it in a pretty grudging way. I don't know if you remember that they actually took more than 5 years to actually bring the bill before Parliament, and when they did so, it was significantly less comprehensive than had originally been promised. And as you say, they tried to water it down again when they'd been in power for a bit longer, and they were beaten back by a coalition of the media, because they were weaker at that point. They didn't have the power that they once had, and they, they couldn't get away with what they once could get away with. Ah, one more at the back, yeah.
Yeah, just asking about how you feel. Trade unions get how do you feel trade unions get reported within the media? Locally, I'd say recently the Evening Post done a very good job with the Keynsham situation, and obviously the home care situation, residential and home care and homes, it was quite a big dispute within that, but it just picked up on public interest. And the point, I just want to know who's doing the gatekeeping about who actually gets on the 24-hour news or within the papers. You're saying about Migration Watch, that's like a one-band operation. But there's plenty of trade unions who actually represent millions or hundreds of thousands of members, and they're just seen as a sectional sort of interest, whereas actually they're representing a whole widespread of people, and there seems to be a sort of this lack of trust sometimes. I just want to know your views.
Yeah, there's no doubt at all that trade unions get far less coverage than they used to. The post of Labour editor or Labour correspondent, which used to be one of the key jobs on a newspaper 20 years ago, is now almost defunct. I think probably is defunct. The last journalist of that title on a national paper, Barry Clement, has just retired. Now, part of the reason, of course, is that the trade unions are frankly less powerful than they were than in the 1970s. They are smaller in size, although of course they've gone back up again a bit recently, and they have less power to affect the lives of ordinary newspaper readers in the way that they once did by withdrawing their labour or whatever, because they do that far less often than they used to. However, that that shouldn't mean that trade unions are ignored. What it does mean, though, is I think trade unions have got to accept they haven't got a right to coverage. They have to work for their coverage, and they have to do some of the things that I was talking about. They have to set themselves up a little bit more like Migration Watch in media terms. Trade unions aren't always particularly brilliant at communicating with the media. Now, they still have resources, they still have staff. They could do this if they wanted to. It wouldn't, they've got the money and the people. They need to have like spin doctors almost. They need to have Andrew Green type figures who can be constantly available to be called on when an event comes up. And they will be called on if to give you an example. I mean, if they can present themselves as representatives of broader interests, like in health stories, I'm struck by the fact there's a huge amount of interest in health, a huge amount of concern about what's going on in the NHS. I'm struck by how seldom trade union voices find their way into that coverage. And yet they represent the workers in the health service. They know things. And the way to prize yourself in that coverage, you've got to, the health unions have got to have a spokesman who can be available for the media, and they've got to have stories. You've got to kind of think, you know, you've got the best sources in the world. You've got your members at the coalface, and they can tell you what's really going on. And you've got to be able to produce an alternative narrative for the media to give it to them, and, you know, to say, actually, well, what the government's saying isn't right. And, and that means organising. It means organising in a different way. You know, you need to set up an intelligence network. You need to tell shop stewards, if you've got a story, tell me. You know, here's my phone number. Here's a line you can call. Here's an email address you can send to, and then we'll get some publicity for it, and we'll get it changed, because that can be more effective sometimes than traditional means, particularly given the kind of legal constraints we've been talking about. And that's, you know, trade unions need to reorganise themselves a bit for the information age, because the old, like I said, the old means of pressure. I mean, I think withdrawal of labour is still the most important thing, because it's a big step. It's a nuclear option. It can go very badly wrong. So there are lots of other things we can do, and trade unions are still, I think, slightly too locked in the traditional mode of operating. So it's not hopeless, but it just needs a bit of work, and it needs a bit more imagination on unions' part. Yeah.
Hello. I'm a journalism student. I've sat here and listened to everything you said tonight, and you painted a really bleak sort of picture on the future of British journalism.
Oh dear. It's not that bad.
Well, I was just wondering, do you have anything reassuring to say? Because, I mean, already you're talking about sort of the state controlling what we print, journalists being arrested, and we're even talking about sort of withholding labour and not working. So, I mean,
Okay, I mean, it's still, like I said, I mean, it still can be an incredible, well, it is an incredibly powerful force. In lots of ways, the media are the most powerful force in civil society, which is something I did say. As other institutions of civil society have withered a bit, like trade unions, obviously they are still very important, but they are not as important as they were, the media has come to sort of fill the vacuum a bit. So actually, if it's done properly, it can still be amazingly powerful and important. And it's like I say, I mean, you know, I mean, my message would hopefully be, and I hope this has come across, but, you know, you don't despair. There, it just, you've got to get round it. You've got to organise in different ways. There are enormous opportunities and enormous possibilities to influence public debate through media organisations of the kind we've discussed, through the media. And if you're working in the media, there's still an enormous amount of good that you can do, an enormous amount of stuff you can do. Frankly, I mean, I'll say this, I mean, you know, it's not just a problem for employers. It's not just a problem of greedy, grasping employers who don't want to invest in journalism. It's also a fact that lots of journalists aren't actually, you know, particularly energetic themselves. Quite a lot of journalists are quite lazy. Quite a lot of journalists are people like, you know, Con Coughlin, who would just take whatever bollocks was given him by the security services and put it in the paper. You know, that there is still one of the nice things I found when I went into journalism. When I started my first job in Fleet Street was on the Sunday Telegraph, and I thought, you know, am I going to be able to cope? Is it going to be all right? You know, is it, they're going to be all incredibly high powered, and it's going to be, you know, they're all going to be incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly clued in. It wasn't like that at all, actually. They were quite clever, most of them, but, you know, it wasn't stratospherically clever. And actually, if you're any good at all, you really can shine in journalism. You really can. Anyway, that's what I think. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to thank, on behalf of the Bristol branch of the NUJ and the NUJ generally, and Arnold Feeney and the City of Bristol, I'd like to thank Andrew for his very enlightening and interesting talk tonight, and all the questions he fielded, and thank you all for coming. I'm interested in the message, and it's interesting that we got a student as the final questioner saying, well, is there any hope? Of course, there has to be hope. We are still a democracy and there's everything to play for. And I hope Andrew made that clear. Just in case you're in any doubt, we've got a DVD of last year's Benn lecture, starring Tony Benn and Alan Hart, and it's on sale at £7 in the foyer 8 right now, produced by Bristol NUJ. So do go and get some for your friends. I know lots of people were disappointed last year, couldn't make it to the lecture, but the entire lecture is on that DVD now to be viewed at leisure. So thanks very much, and we'll see you in the bar, hopefully. Thank you.